Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Very special day for you. It's a Shore's Day Thursday with Michael Shore. Michael, how's it going? Welcome back to the show.
It was going really, really well until about a second.
The only thing that would have made that better for me and worse for you is if we'd had an animated intro ready to go, but alas, we're not quite there. But anyway, Michael Shore has recently been freed up a little bit to come back to TYT, his true family, and we've been very glad to have him back. And it's always a treat to get to do a show with you, Michael.
I love doing it. This is home.
Thank you, thank you. And you've been doing it since the beginning, basically.
I wasn't there on the first day. I started on the second day. So
that's just always got to burn just a little bit. Do they lord it over you?
Right. One less day that I got to spend in Jenks' apartment.
There you go. Yeah. Well, TYT is about to hit a big milestone, by the way, entering into the 20th anniversary. So that's going to be exciting. We'll have more info to come on that. But it's a particularly good day to have Michael on the show today because we have a lot to talk about, including updates on the Senate Judiciary Committee, what they've found out about Donald Trump and the DOJ's actions leading up to inauguration, and of course leading up to the insurrection itself. Some spicy stuff there. Updates on the Texas abortion law, as well as Manchin and Sinema have spent the past couple of months figuring out different ways of spitting in our face, and today they've got new ones. So Manchin's got a sort of policy-based one. Sinema's got just a sort of personal little thing we want to show you. So those will be fun. And then once we get into the latter half of the show, two things to look forward to. So one is, meanwhile, in news from around the world, we've got some stories there for you. And then we're going to have Anna Kasparian debating Ben Shapiro. So that happened earlier this week. We've got some of those videos. We're going to be taking a look at those and discussing them. You know that that's going to be fun. So please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already, so that people know we're live. And with that, Michael, you ready to jump into this thing?
Let's do it. I'll see if I remember how.
Okay, I think you're experienced. The Senate Judiciary Committee has released an interim report on what Donald Trump was doing or planning to do to try to stop Joe Biden from becoming president. And there's some spicy stuff in this. Days before he left office, President Donald Trump was weighing a last-ditch effort to force the Justice Department to do his bidding and overturn the election results. He almost went through with it, but was talked off the ledge when his White House counsel called it a, quote, murder-suicide pact, and he and his deputy threatened to resign. So that's strong language. Apparently, Trump repeatedly asked DOJ leadership to endorse his false claim that the election was stolen and declare the election corrupt. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows asked Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen to initiate election fraud investigations on multiple occasions. So you already here have some people willing to go along with it, this so-called, you know, murder-suicide pact. Others saying, no, if you try to do this, we will will leave the administration and presumably bring their story to the press. Not only these high ups, but potentially more people in the DOJ. There could be these mass resignations. So we have a lot more details on this. But Michael, I'm in a bubble. We're all in bubbles, I guess. I'm in a bubble. I was inclined to say I'm shocked at how little people really care about how far this went or how close we came to a more significant constitutional crisis. Am I right? Do people care? Do people remember? Have we just moved on? What's you've been traveling all over the place. What's your perception?
I think the people that care care, if that's understandable, meaning that I don't think there are a lot of people to convince on either side. I think the people that have their heels dug in, sadly, on behalf of Donald Trump, are not going to waver. There's no new evidence that could possibly, if January 6th didn't change minds, then knowing how it was facilitated is not going to change minds. And I it's a terrible truth to have to reckon with, but you still have to follow it through. Because justice, knows no friend, right? I mean, they have to be able to push through with what they find, whether or not it sways public opinion. Right now, you have Republican senators, Republican congresspeople, many of whom were elected before Donald Trump even announced he was running for office, who are adherent to what he did and how his demeanor has survived his administration. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to hurt them, I still believe, in the long run. And I think that this will be a historical blip to a certain extent that's going to infect a certain segment of the Republican Party. But I think after that, you have to be able to push through this and go after the people who did wrong. And you know, it also puts people makes people look better. Jeffrey Rosen looks a lot better than he did to me when he was Attorney General, since I know more about this. So it also, as horrible as it makes a lot of people look, it makes some people look a little better.
Yeah. Some of the people that look worse would be the right wing media that has been covering for this from the very beginning. The sort of, it's not even a 1-2 punch. It's like a 1-2-3-4-5 punch of all the different ways that they tried to stop Joe Biden from becoming president, from legitimizing the court cases that went nowhere. They lost literally dozens of them. This stuff behind the scenes, I'm going to make a bold prediction that Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro, Matt Walsh, all of them will not do 5 collective seconds covering this. But if Obama or if Biden, if Clinton had done something like this in the last moments of their presidency, can you imagine what they would say? Now, if you were to pin them down and throw this in their face, they would say, well, it's different. And what's different about it is the election was stolen. Which is, of course, frustrating because they have thus far, with about a year, have not been able to put together one shred of evidence that there was some sort of impropriety that materially affected the outcome of the 2020 election. But the assumed corrupt nature of the election has provided license not only for what we found so far, and even if we find worse, if there's emails released of Trump saying literally, I'm gonna steal it and I need your help, like they wouldn't care. They continue to like, I think it was who's the talking points guy? Charlie Kirk gave some speech like yesterday or 2 days ago where he said it was literally just people walking in to take selfies in the Capitol. Like that is how he is continuing to describe January 6th. And I get it, they're not legitimate, but they have a lot of people that believe them, and no amount of evidence is gonna fight back against that. And that's incredibly frustrating.
A Republican representative from Georgia is the one who said that it was just tourists doing being tourists, people going through being tourists. And there was very little blowback. There were some chuckles, but there was very little blowback except from some Democratic members of Congress. And, you know, to go to your point about Fox News and whether it was Obama, I mean, we could whether it was Obama all day long about so many things. And it's not. That it's not that there isn't a media that points out the faults of Trump, but there is a media that disproportionately defends him or ignores those things. And that is where the whole media bias thing has it wrong, that people that say that there's this left-wing media bias. When something happens to someone on the left, if it were Donald Trump on the left and these were legitimate concerns, and I mean, concern is a light word, but charges, you would have a media in large part going after and looking for answers from the person, as opposed to the defense that you get on the other side. Now, of course, people defended Bill Clinton for what happened in the Oval Office and his extramarital affair. I think mostly because, and it was partisan, but mostly because it rose to a different level. It was,
sure.
it was unseemly, it was all of that, but it's a little different than what we're talking about here.
Exactly. Yeah. And look, I think that there is, look, I can't speak for everyone. There are crazy people out there, but I think that there is a level of consistency there. Donald Trump has in terms of scandals like this, the most substantive level of scandals, the Ukraine and all of that, the election challenge. He also had the scandals around extramarital affairs. Who was Rashida Tlaib trying to impeach him over the affair? No, nobody was trying to do that. Now, the hush money payments that seemed to be campaign finance violations, there were certainly talks about that. But we do actually focus on the most substantive parts. Now, that said, I want to make sure that you know as much as possible about what has been revealed. So we're going to push through a little bit more of what's been released in this interim report. So Jeffrey Bossert Clark, a Trump ally, told Rosen he would decline Trump's potential offer to install him as acting attorney general if Rosen agreed to publicly announce that the DOJ was investigating election fraud and tell key swing state legislatures they should appoint alternate slates of electors following certification of the popular vote. That to me is honestly probably the most important part of this, that one of the goals was to have official DOJ sanction for the rival electors that were in the addled fever, riddled mind of Trump, the plan for Pence to overturn the results, to effectively try to throw it to the House of Representatives or whatever. I don't know what part the DOJ has in any of that hypothetically, but that was the goal. Get the DOJ to say that these rival slates of electors from places like Arizona and others are like, we want you to send those, giving a pall of legitimacy to them. And then that would potentially be used to have Pence refuse to certify the results and, a billion different weird steps after that. Supposedly the Republicans in the state legislatures or the House or whatever would make Trump president. So that is very significant. And again, thankfully, Rosen was not down for that.
He wasn't down for it, and to his credit, and it is very significant, as you say. But what should concern all of us is that there are people that think that this is okay. And the more that this becomes okay, the more that's what our future looks like, a further politicization of election boards and panels. And that's what is dangerous here, that this is an idea that's in the mind of a lot of people who think it's a pretty good idea. And it's not just about Donald Trump, it's whoever the Donald Trump would be in that particular election. And they are going to try and manipulate the way we vote in this country for a long time, as long as more people are voting and voting rights laws are relaxed, and that's what they're trying to tamp down on.
Yeah. Well, there's two more bad people I want to make sure that we focus on. One of them is Trump, who allegedly, according to Donahue and Rosen, told DOJ leadership, "You guys aren't following the internet the way I do." I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's like, you aren't aware of what's going on like I am, because I read on Eagle Chan that there was big dumps. I don't know if that's what he means, or if he just means, no, you guys don't get it. People are really pissed. They really want to make sure we overthrow this thing. But either way, I doubt it was particularly persuasive to the leadership of the Department of Justice that, like, the stuff he's reading on Twitter, they aren't coming across. But he found it to be persuasive anyway.
What's great is that you don't sound like Donald Trump, but you sound like Alec Baldwin doing Donald Trump.
No, that's the worst.
I know.
I don't accept it.
But it's true.
And that was how John stopped doing it. Anyway, but it's not just him. We also have William Barr. Hey, remember William Barr? He was terrible. We just moved on as a country, all the stuff he did. He seemed to be potentially exposed in the whole Ukraine thing, trying to stop a whistleblower from revealing all this, and then everyone just moved on. Okay, I guess we're done with him. But he was involved in this too. So the Senate panel found that Attorney General William Barr personally demanded that the department investigate voter fraud allegations, even if other authorities had looked into them and not found evidence of wrongdoing. These allegations included a claim by Rudy Giuliani that he had a tape that showed Democratic poll workers kicking their Republican counterparts from a polling station and fraudulently adding votes for Joe Biden into the count. And the New York Times points out that as Attorney General, Mr. Barr weakened the department's decades-long strict policy of not taking investigative steps in fraud cases until after an election is certified, a measure meant to keep the fact that a federal investigation from impacting the election outcome. So, I guess you have your column of the people who look better, including Rosen. William Barr, I hadn't really heard too much about his involvement. In fact, I I can't be specific, but anecdotally, it seemed like he was presenting himself as standing against the election claims in December, if I remember. I don't know. What's your memory of that?
Yeah, that's how I sort of pictured it, the public face. I think, you know, and I would have to look at the timeline of when he started to, you know, appear that way to me, and I guess to you as well. But it may have been when a certain number of court cases had already failed and he realized it was a sinking ship. But he may have, you know, and apparently according to this, and if this is accurate, he was as bad as the rest of them, but he just got off the boat a little sooner.
Yeah. Well, a couple more details. One, Dick Durbin put out a tweet following the release of the interim report saying, "This report reveals that we were only a half step away from a full-blown constitutional crisis as Donald Trump and his loyalists threatened a wholesale takeover of DOJ. As chair of the committee, I can promise that we will continue to investigate this matter," which this is an interim report, so yes, presumably that is going to happen. Michael, what are your expectations or hopes that will come out of a continued investigation? Like, you know, There are already reports that some of the senior Trump aides aren't going to comply with the January 6th investigation. Trump's going to claim executive privilege for the vast majority of this. Do you expect anything to come out?
You know, I do because I'm an optimist, but I also think it's important. I don't think that, look, he was impeached twice and he survived those impeachments. He is a former president. I think this is about doing the sort of non-sexy work of politics, which is making sure that there are safeguards against this happening and the people pay for it who were part of it. And I don't think this is gonna be, you know, there's gonna be some big moment where they start parading former officials into jail or in front of like doing perp walks in front of loads of media. I don't think that's what you're gonna get here. But I do think that you're gonna have somebody like Dick Durbin saying that they are going to see this through. And that's important. It's important that it not just die on the vine, and whether or not it shows us, look, it's important to me that these people pay for what they did, yeah. But it's also important that they get to the bottom of what happened and people, and there are attempts to punish these people. And I think there's going to be criminal threats actually against these people for not testifying.
Okay, well, I will definitely be down to see that. But you brought up the safeguards against this happening again, because you know, there's two different focuses that you could have, or both. One is making sure everyone knows exactly what happened. I think people should know. It seems less and less every year that it matters that people know or that they care to know. But I think people should know what happened. And then there's also the stuff in the future. So what is the likelihood that in 2024 we're going to experience the same thing or worse, a version of it that actually succeeds in overthrowing an election? Really fast, let's talk about the safeguards. So they tried in a bunch of different ways to overthrow this thing. And in the wake of that, so throughout 2021, what has been done that makes it more likely, and what has been done that makes it less likely? So we know that in a lot of different states, they have taken more control over the powers of the Secretary of State, the ability to throw out the people in charge of state elections. They have suppressed the vote in literally hundreds of different ways. They're doing these audits and announcing that they will be coming in other places, like they're targeting Atlanta in Georgia. Like, there's a lot of stuff that seems like they are setting up to do this again. Michael, what has been done at the state level or at the federal level that you feel significantly lowers the chance that an attempt to overthrow the election in 2024 would be successful?
Well, I think some of the intangible stuff, like the fact that it's in the public zeitgeist, that people are aware of it and people are running for office and people who are running states understand that it's not acceptable and that those people, again, are gonna have louder voices. I think you talked about Georgia, and that to me is sort of the scariest state because it's a state that I think they're gonna go after these purple states, as it were, states that went Democrat, that had previously gone Republican, maybe Arizona, but certainly Georgia. I think the biggest safeguard there would be electing Stacey Abrams to governor and not to have the state controlled by the people that tried to push Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, out, who tried to push back against a governor who was actually Brian Kemp doing the right thing, and not the, you know, I'm not a Brian Kemp fan, obviously, but doing the right thing against what was against that wave. It needs to be contagious. So that's a big part of it, is that it's out there, but also people have to understand that electorally they can stop it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up. We should remember that you know, one of the reasons some of this stuff failed was not because you had Democrats in the right places, but you had some Republicans that for all of the, you know, myriad ways that they're likely troglodytes on basically every policy, they weren't willing to literally just steal the election. And many of them, that's the end of their career as a result of that. And in a lot of those positions, we are not going to have those next time. They are going to be replaced by Trump loyalists. And then, of course, you have the Republican senators and all of that that didn't take the right position even the first time around. And I'm sure the people running in Republican primaries for 2022, gee, I wonder which way they're going to lean on these sorts of things if they want to get Trump to support them and win these elections. So I don't know. I am horrified. My experience over the Trump years has been that relying on anything that is not strictly codified in law has failed time and time again, that the traditions and norms have failed. The expectation that shame or public awareness could affect behavior has failed. Not always. There are some Republicans who voted to to impeach Donald Trump or convict Donald Trump. But the vast majority, two times around, like trying to in advance overthrow an election and then trying after the election overthrow the election, is two different impeachments, just stood with him because at the end of the day, they could succeed. And so they went with the power rather than, you know, considerations of the public and stuff like that. And so I don't know, I feel like if they had better numbers, like next time around, I'm just very worried, Michael. I guess I'm not an optimist when it comes to this sort of thing.
Well, yeah, you should be worried. I'm worried too. I'm not an optimist, but I do. I mean, I'm an optimist, but I'm not optimistic about this, because what you said that's most important is that they've shifted norms, and when norms shift, it becomes less predictable, and that's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah. Really fast, I just want to mention, we're not going to go in depth on this, but there was news earlier today that lawyers are prepping an attempt to get the Scottish government to investigate Trump's golf course, Turnberry. One of the key things of this seems to be the odd manner in which it was bought. Trump bought it with cash after a career of, you know, borrowing money for these sorts of things, and they believe there could be some sort of shadiness there. There isn't much that's been publicly revealed that I'm aware of to this, so I don't have much to say, but just understand that his potential legal troubles, at the very least, continue in multiple countries. Any thoughts about that, Michael?
No, I mean, you know, that's the stuff that could really actually get Donald Trump. Our business dealings like this, if the politics part is not going to be successful in getting Donald Trump or having some stink on him that people run from, at least in business, they're going to. He's already dropped out of the Forbes 400, which is, you know, the worst thing that could possibly happen to him.
Yeah, it's an early bit of Schadenfreude here at the Damage Report. But anyway, and I'm just going to throw this out. It was just one of the lingering thoughts. You know, sometimes I get nostalgic. Robert Mueller never made Trump testify in person. Isn't that crazy in hindsight? Like a multi-year investigation into all of these alleged crimes, his lawyers just submitted some vague answers written down. It's amazing. Anyway, okay, we have a lot more to get to, but first we are going to take a break. I'm going to answer some of your questions, comments, and concerns. We'll have more news after this. Okay, everybody, let's talk about some at least temporary good news. That's the best, or at the least most available kind of good news that we have in American politics these days. The draconian Texas abortion law is, at the very least for a bit, halted. A federal judge late yesterday granted the Justice Department's request to halt enforcement of it. Judge Pittman used sharp language to criticize the law known as Senate Bill 8, which was drafted to make it difficult to challenge in court by delegating enforcement to private individuals who can sue anyone who performs abortions or aids and abets them. If that sounds vague to you, it's because yeah, it is. That's what it was designed to do. And if you're not familiar with this, the Texas law bans abortions once cardiac activity can be detected in an embryo, usually after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Those are called heartbeat bills, even though what they're detecting are not heartbeats. It's electrical activity on a few different cardiac cells. Healthcare experts say women may not even know they're pregnant during that time frame, and the law makes no exception for pregnancies that are the results of rape or incest. It made no, you know, exceptions for women's constitutional rights. Why should it care about those things? In any event, for right now, Michael, it is being held. Texas is appealing that decision, obviously. But we've been kind of waiting for this to see if it would happen. And at least for now, we have that.
Well, we were waiting for it, but so too were the people who put the law into place. They put in provisions to this that even if sued or even if upheld, even if this were upheld by the courts, that they would put into place a retroactive penalty because they feel that the circuit court is going to take the block away. Put in a retroactive penalty to those providers who provide abortions during this interim time so that they can go back, and if an abortion is performed after 6 weeks, they can criminally go after those abortion providers who did that during this interregnum. They think that the circuit court, which is a conservative court, is going to overturn what this judge has done. So that's the scary part here as well.
Yeah, maybe you can answer this. And if not, I wish we had Adrian here. I'm not a lawyer. How is that constitutional? Because I thought one of the sort of like core components of law is that you cannot criminalize something that happened before it was against the law. Like as of right now, this is not the law,
right,
in Texas. It's not illegal to do this. So how can you then say, well, if you had done it during that time, you can be sued? That seems like one of the core things. And again, I'm very much obviously not a lawyer.
Yeah, I think, and I won't speak for Adrian, but I think that lawyers don't believe that is something that would stand up, actually. It's a scare tactic. It's extra constitutional. You're right. I mean, if a federal court says this cannot go forward, then right now you are obeying the law if you do what they say, what they want to make illegal until such a time as it is. So retroactive punishment during for a time that where it is legal seems extra constitutional. It's a scare tactic, though, and yeah, probably a good one.
Yeah, well, so someone said you can't put into a law that the law still applies if it's struck down. Yeah, because even that component has been struck down, at least temporarily. Yeah, the entire, and look, and theoretically, if we're onto something, that could be used to knock down the law. But look, what we are in some ways criticizing is the sort of like intellectual or philosophical honesty of the bill, which right, is, it's not designed to do that. It's not, they're not making it be. They didn't do the $10,000 bounty system because they thought, you know, we've really thought about it and we think this is consistent with American legal principles and that's what we need to do. All of this is strategic. The battleground that they want to outlaw it everywhere at all times, and this is basically fun and games until the, you know, massively conservative Supreme Court takes it up. And it's even more fun for everyone in America, especially people who might desire an abortion to exercise their rights, in that this might not even be the thing that results in Roe v. Wade being overturned. There's multiple challenges that might result in that right now. So that's fun. Always remember the Supreme Court when choosing who to support for president. I'll just say that yet again. Anyway, I want to give you a little bit of what Judge Pittman said. From the moment SB 8 went into effect, women have been unlawfully prevented from exercising control over their own lives in ways that are protected by the Constitution. This court will not sanction one more day of this offensive deprivation of such an important right. Yes, and that is good. It is good to have someone in a position of power that thinks that women losing a right that they've had for half a century is significant. I would love to see more politicians doing that. You know, maybe the ones that control the country. That would be great, to take it seriously. We haven't really seen much of that. Instead, we get to have a debate about the Hyde Amendment in the infrastructure bill. We want to send a very clear message to the women of Texas. though we are not Republicans, kind of agree with him on some things. That's always fun. Anyway, yeah, well, so Texas has appealed to the US Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, quite conservative. Supposedly, a decision on this on the appeal could come as soon as a few days. So, you know, like if you're gonna have a party over this, do it tonight because it might not last the weekend. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It probably won't last the weekend, or it'll last the weekend and not much past that. And this is all headed to the Supreme Court, and whether or not the court takes it up is a different question. I think a Ginsburg-less court is something that John Roberts knows that he may not want to oversee when it comes to Roe v. Wade. He may not have an option if there's a preponderance of cases. But I do think that that's what they're after here. They're after reelecting, getting conservative Christian voters to the ballot boxes to reelect a Republican Congress and Republican governors next year, and to test the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and look, I'm curious to see what's going to happen. It is an incredibly ideologically conservative court. They didn't bring Amy Coney Barrett because she's just the best of the best, or whatever. That said, like
how different things would be if Ruth Bader Ginsburg lived for like four more months. And it's an incredible thing to say. I mean, wonderful that she lived in well into her whatever 90s, but it really did make a big difference. And also, if the Democrats had not folded when Merrick Garland was their nominee for the court, yeah. These things matter more than any of the other things we talk about in any other show or at any other time. It's what happens at the high court.
They do. They can't stress it enough. But we'll see. I mean, this bill is just hot garbage. It is nonsense. It is obvious what the goal is. And we'll see. Will the Supreme Court find it a bridge too far? Like, they want to do this, but like with this, I don't know. Why not? We were just talking about power is power. The members of SCOTUS are not angels, okay? They're Amy Coney Barrett could have been a Republican senator. Like, you know, if you had had a slight what if situation. You know, if she'd had a conversation with Star-Lord instead of getting on the Supreme Court, suddenly she's a senator. So it'll be a fun year coming up when it comes to reproductive rights. That said, let's turn to something very different, though equally frustrating, I think. What does Joe Manchin want when it comes to the reconciliation infrastructure bill? Well, he's got a fun game. He wants progressives to pick just one of President Biden's three signature policies for helping working families and discard the other two. If only they had a movie with this sort of as its core, like, I don't know, like Manchin's Choice, something like that. So this is what Axios says. And by the way, Hans Nichols, the person who wrote this article, is the person who wrote all that fawning coverage of Kyrsten Sinema, so just bear that in mind. Says, by forcing progressives to choose among an expanded child tax credit, paid family medical leave, or subsidies for childcare, Manchin is complicating any potential deal, but also signaling his willingness to negotiate. And this week, we doubled down on TDR's commitment to not make this most important of fights just about the duels between politicians and make sure that people understand the cost. So I will add, in addition to complicating any potential deal, but also signaling his willingness to negotiate, he signaled his willingness to allow people who've been suffering to continue to suffer on two out of three important priorities of the president, who ran on those priorities, was elected over an incumbent president on those priorities. The Senate was then given to him, presumably so that his agenda could go into effect. And Manchin is saying, no, you get one of the three. So let's just bear in mind the substance as well. But anyway, we're gonna give you some numbers on what this represents. But Michael, what do you think about this?
Like, I mean, first of all, I think it's a juvenile way to do politics. I think it's torture to force your colleagues to have to do that. That's not the way things are done. You don't go into a jury room and average out what 12 different jurors think the award should be in a case and then come up with that number. That's not how it's done. This isn't how it's done either. And I don't think that it's typical Democratic politics, Democratic capital D part politics, because they usually try and help a broad swath because they have a bigger tent of people to whom that is important. If Manchin has presidential aspirations, which I believe more and more, I didn't used to think he did, but the fact that he's doing these sorts of things is trying to say, I'm just not a socialist, and he's saying it out loud. But I'll let you have a little bite of socialism because we got to get this thing done. That's not the way to boil this down. I think it's a horrendous, horrendous play by Joe Manchin, and I understand the frustration of his Democratic colleagues.
Yeah, it's childish. It's just cruel. It's take one of three. I don't care. I have no vested interest. I don't like. These represent, let's say you could only have one of the three, like that was an absolute baked into the physical constants of the universe. It would matter which. I don't even know which is more important, but I'm sure there's one that's more important, or you could at least try to make the case based on your perspective. The idea that, whatever, that's insane. I do want to pause for 1 second though, before we move on to the numbers, because I've never heard anything about his presidential aspirations. So I gotta hear more about this.
Well,
who would he be running for?
Well, I mean, I think that he probably fancies himself, and some people do, as a candidate who could win Republican votes and win Democratic votes as well. And so I think to that extent, that's where his appeal would lie. And he probably thinks, okay, I can get some reasonable Republican support, and Democrats are going to go for me because it's going to be a crazy Republican. So I can actually be a successful candidate. It's not a terrible blueprint for somebody like Joe Manchin. It's kind of Bill Clinton cuts the same figure, but with less of the progressive inclinations that Clinton had. And so I do think that that's an important factor here. And I think it's much more important than I used to think. But again, in this case, there's not a progressive or a Democrat out there who would reward someone who's essentially saying to members of Congress and his own party, you have to pick between one of your three children, who's your favorite child? Yeah. That's what he's asking for now.
Oh, so you got that reference I was making. I thought it was a deep one. Anyway, look, I think the template that you talked about, I get that, but there's a primary. Like, there were, you know, moderates in the 2020 like primary. There's like 1,000 people, but like, why would we choose that person in a primary?
Well, to an extent, I think you're probably being facetious that you think that's who was chosen last time, and to an extent it was. But being out on the
trip, I mean more than Biden. I'm saying there were definitely.
But what we found was that people, the majority of Democrats, it's not about ideology. It wasn't certainly this time. It was about electability. And if Donald Trump was had been the candidate, anyone who they felt, and whether they were right or wrong, whether all of them could have beaten Trump or not, or only Biden could have, doesn't matter. The majority of Democratic voters in the primaries thought that Joe Biden, flaws and all, had the best chance of beating Trump. And if they think that about Joe Manchin, and it's Donald Trump again, or Trump Jr., or someone Trump-like, then it might be the same thing. Again, this is not being talked about a lot. I'm just looking at how his trajectory and his behavior here, because I find a lot of it curious too. Does he want to be governor of West Virginia again? Yeah, maybe, but he doesn't have to do this to be governor. Joe Manchin would win the governorship again, I believe, even though West Virginia was a 40-point plus state for Trump. So that's why I look at this, and I don't think the primary would be as tough. It would be tough, and he might not hold up and all of that, but I think electability is something that some people might look at Joe Manchin and say, well, he has a better shot of beating them. I don't know. I'm not saying I agree. Okay. I don't want to be president.
I said that Biden had no chance. So what do I know? But
you'll remember when he entered the race, what I said, which was that Biden's going to be the nominee.
I feel like you were still somehow wrong. I can't define how, but I still think Manchin has no chance.
I have a lot of bad predictions. When I make a good one, I just want it to be right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yeah. I think sometimes
the results of my prediction, John, you can't go to the courts and you can't. Yeah,
No, there was, unfortunately, you know, right before the South Carolina primary, there were some big dumps. So I think that threw it a bit. But anyway, yeah, so freaking Sinema and Manchin. This is terrible. I want to read this quote by Bernie Sanders.
Because you don't know what motivates Kyrsten Sinema. That's the thing.
That's true. Oh, no, we're going to get to that in one moment. But I want to give you an alternative to what Manchin is doing. Sanders says the time is long overdue for him to tell us with specificity, not generalities. We're beyond generalities, with specificity, what he wants and what he does not want, and to explain that to the people of West Virginia and America. I think he should definitely stand before America and tell them you get one of these three things.
Yeah, that's a
pair. What you can have food or shelter or love. You pick one.
I mean, what Sanders said there is perfect. That's exactly what Joe Manchin needs to do, and that's exactly what Bernie Sanders needs to tell him, and other senators need to tell him to do. Because you don't really know what's motivating. That's why we had a 4-minute conversation about does he want to be president. I don't know that he does, but this is the kind of thing, because it's so curious, that makes you wonder what the next ambition would be, because it doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Well, we're gonna have a little bit more on this on Sinema when we come back from a break, but we do have to take it. Stick around, we'll be back in just a few. Yeah, my brother is named Drew and he is in Georgia.
Can you so
is this my brother?
This is a kid thing here. What is this gifting subs and what, tell me, explain. Okay.
So being a subscriber on the Twitch channel gives you some perks, the ability to use like emojis and things like that. It's a paid thing. You can buy a gift sub that goes to someone who's watching the show and they become a subscriber for a month. So you're buying it for them, basically.
I see. How much is a sub?
I think it's $5 for the tier one sub.
That's nice. So somebody gave $50 for 10 subs. That's pretty good.
Oh yeah. Oh, and Obi-Wan Kenobi has given many more than that. Obi-Wan Kenobi, like, we have a lot of very generous people in our Twitch community. Obi-Wan Kenobi reigns over them, godlike, like a Joe Manchin over Joe Biden.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's what he's supposed to do, right?
Exactly. Okay, couple things we want to get to in what remains of this first hour. So why don't we? Apologies. Jump into this. In fact, you know what? Let's go directly to this video.
And went up.
And they went up
to bring them back. So we call that the mail shuttle.
I love it.
Hi.
Thank you.
Hi there. Hi, Congresswoman. Who are you gonna leave out for the Build Back Better Biden agenda? Can you talk with us, please, today, Congresswoman? Senator Sinema, would you please tell the majority of Americans who support Build Back Better why you won't vote for it?
So that continues until she gets into a car, flashes a little smile, and drives away. Now, you might be inclined to be a little bit like offended. It was a little bit condescending that the only thing she would respond to is senator, but I actually like it. She does in fact remember that she's a senator. I hadn't been sure recently. I'm glad to have that confirmed by Kyrsten Sinema.
Well, it annoyed me too, because I hate when people do that. Like, I mean, I was like, I hadn't seen that actually, that clip, and I was thinking, She's a senator. That's the only thing that Kyrsten Sinema has done in a while that makes me smile. But yeah, I mean, this is out of hand. Yeah, we talked about it just a little while ago. We don't know what's, at least with Joe Manchin, even though it's muddled and hard to understand, he does give you updates on where he stands on this stuff. And with Kyrsten Sinema, you don't know any of it. And is it just a power play? As a matter of fact, she could actually be bluffing. Mm-hmm. Way and then come around. We don't even know that, but it seems not, because so many senators have said there are two senators that stand in the way. So
yeah. Can I? You know, I'm going to reveal some ignorance, I guess. So generally, when you say congressperson, you mean someone who serves in the House of Representatives. But she is in Congress,
right?
It's not inaccurate necessarily. It's not the norm.
No, but you're a member of.
You say representative for a person in the House of Representatives, you say senator for someone in the Senate, but Congress is both.
No, forms of address are, when you're a senator, you're a senator. You're not congresswoman anymore. And if you were in the Congress, you
should there be like a minimum bar of how much of a senator you are to deserve that?
That's actually,
anyway.
That's actually in the Build Back Better bill.
There you go. Well, then that probably explains why she doesn't like it. It's so personal.
Yeah.
Also on the personal angle, you know who else isn't a big fan of cinema, at least seemingly in this? So following the protest of the young woman who followed cinema into a bathroom, there was an email exchange between Senate Democratic leadership aides obtained by Axios, reveals that Senator Bernie Sanders withheld his name from a joint statement declaring protesters who'd done that and filmed her while using the restroom, well, being in the restroom, I don't think she used the restroom. Anyway, as plainly inappropriate and unacceptable. So he withheld his support for that letter because it also wouldn't include a rebuke of her political views. So apparently what they wanted was a preface which said, while we hope Senator Sinema will change her position on prescription drug reform and support a major budget reconciliation bill, blah, blah, blah. So that was supposed to be the bargain. But apparently an aide for Senator Cory Booker said Booker would not accept the edits. He did not want references to how she was trying to tank Biden's agenda. What do you think about that?
I mean, if I had to vote, I'd probably vote for Booker there. I think you gotta make the point about how inappropriate it is to follow someone into a bathroom and do that. We all know where the party is on cinema, and to make it about the policy, I mean, I wouldn't have spent even as much time as I've spent answering your question just now on it. I just think that, you know, you make your point and then you move on, and then you can excoriate cinema for other reasons that are substantive. But this is a general sense of decency thing.
Sure. Super fast, final point on this. I'm just curious. I've been going back and forth on this. A lot of people come on the show have. Manchin or Sinema, who's more annoying? Or insert whatever word you want, but who gets your goat more during this whole thing?
Well, Manchin, because he's more powerful. That's why he's taken more seriously and he's more powerful and he knows better. Sinema has been kind of a bit of a gadfly all along, and you know, I wanted her to win and an important part of the majority and all of that, but I think Manchin he can do better.
Okay.
I think if Manchin,
I'm really torn.
If Manchin moves, Sinema follows. I don't think there's one senator. It wouldn't be 51-49 with Sinema holding out. It just wouldn't happen.
We'll see. Okay, really fast, final story to close out the hour. Let's jump into this. When you think of One America News, what do you think of? I don't know. Maybe you think of insane questions to Donald Trump in the White House press room. Maybe you think of Tommy Lauren. I think she got her start at OAN. Do you think of AT&T? Well, maybe you should, because this week we found out that AT&T has provided tens of millions of dollars in funding to OAN. In fact, representing 90% of its revenue from a contract with AT&T owned television platforms, including DirecTV. This is according to an OAN accountant in sworn testimony from 2020. So on the funding side, AT&T is, from what OAN is saying, very important to them, but also in terms of the creation of the network in the beginning. So Robert Herring Sr. is the founder of OAN, said they told us they wanted a conservative network. They only had one, which was Fox News. I dispute that. Anyway, and they had seven others on the other left wing side. When they said that, I jumped to it and built one. And of course, this is interesting for a lot of different reasons, but the fact that AT&T owns Warner Media, which owns CNN, so they sort of are responsible for CNN and OAN, of CNN being the left-wing one out of this. Anyway, I was shocked by this, Michael. What do you think about this revelation about their funding?
I think it's pretty surprising. I don't know clearly enough about it, and I don't think anybody does. And even if I knew about it, I wouldn't be able to analyze it perfectly because I don't know what goes into these massive telecom deals to get carriage and coverage. And yes, AT&T owns DirecTV; they didn't always own them. But the fact that they were, you know, propping this place up when they could have propped up something else is really curious, and I think deserves further examination. This is not, first of all, and the notion that there are seven other OANs on the left on DirecTV is absurd. I mean, it's really ridiculous if they call that CNN. Maybe if they want to equate MSNBC, and I'm loath to even say this, with Fox, they make a better argument, but there are not seven others over there. Yeah. And opinion shows on Fox and the opinion shows on OAN are far different, vastly different from any of them anywhere else.
Yeah, you're totally right. And it's not just that OAN is right wing or like Fox News. I mean, the lines are blurring more than they were a few years ago, perhaps. But no, they were like, with Newsmax, the most vigorous in pushing complete lies about the election, as well as QAnon. Chanel Rion, the reporter for OAN, talks about QAnon in a variety of different forms. Like, this is really crazy. OAN is suspended on YouTube. Like, and AT&T is pumping millions of dollars into them, which, as people point out on the chat, we're close to the weekend. John Oliver, who loves to talk about AT&T, what he calls his business daddy, I have a feeling he's probably gonna have fun with this. And AT&T probably has some splaining to do. Anyway, no. Any quick final thoughts?
No, I mean that's exactly right. There's going to be more on this, and AT&T is definitely going to talk about what this means. But OAN is off the charts. They are liars. It's fiction.
They're the craziest of the crazies. It's almost admirable if it wasn't so abhorrent. Anyway, use that as a tagline, OAN. Anyway, okay, so if you're watching on our linear platforms, thank you so much for watching. We appreciate you being here, but that is the end of our first hour. If you're on the Members app or on YouTube or on Twitch, we've got more news, including Meanwhile In, as well as Anna Kasparian's debate with Ben Shapiro. That is coming up after this. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.